Everybody, welcome to Carson City Off-Road live podcast. We have one guy that's excited in the corner. There we go. We're stoked to have you guys here. We have two of the best mountain bikers in the country and even in the world with us right now. It's pretty awesome. Sophia Gomez Villafane and Payson McKelvin. Can you give them a round of applause, everybody? All right, so if you don't know, so I'm what the British would call a punter, just an average Joe, and Nate on the other side, also an average Joe, but we're coaches and we like to try to make people faster, especially through this podcast. So we dig into all the details. We have to try really hard to be fast and do all that stuff. So we get into the details. That's what we're going to do here. So first off, we're going to talk about Carson City Off-Road and how you prep for this event and how you guys are going to execute for this event. So I guess starting first with you, Sophia, the first thing I want to ask is when you come into a race like this, you have a fat tire crit coming in, but how do you change your training? Do you like ramp up into something like this or do you just rest and go easy? What's your final week look like before an event like this?
You know, this week has been really different for me. Are we good? Sorry. Good. This week has been really different for me. I came off from a week off racing like 2 weeks ago. So then I raced Missoula, Montana last weekend, and that was a really good opener. So I basically just did recovery. I did a 3-hour endurance day and recovery. The crit was a great opener and another recovery day today. I haven't pre-ridden the course much just because saving the legs for Sunday is all that matters.
Yeah. So is that like a really light week for you?
Yeah, like normally if I'm training, I'm anywhere between 12 to 18.
So for you, Payson, what are you doing when you come into a week like this? You didn't race Missoula. Was it different for you? Did you keep things ramped up?
Yeah, so I think one of the challenges and things that a lot of people don't realize about having a full pro race schedule is that you can't be good for every race weekend. And so you're constantly balancing training and race performance. For me, the Epic Ride Series is a big goal, and so I'm always trying to come into these rested. Unfortunately, I got sick for 2 straight weeks after Marathon Nationals.
Leaning away from Payson right now.
Yeah, and so I have been scrambling a little bit since then to get back to where I was early season. And so, yeah, there was a little more volume than I probably wanted to have in the 10 days before this. But in this week specifically, what I did was just on Monday, I had a 2-hour pretty intense interval day.
Okay.
And then Tuesday, I did our infamous Tuesday night group ride in Durango, more for leg speed. And just, it was almost like midweek openers, you could think of it. Awesome. Think of it as. And then 2 very easy days, crit, rest today. And hopefully I'll be good to go.
Cool. There's a few things I want to touch on here. And just so that you know, joining us live on the internet, tens of thousands of people too. So they're getting some Carson City Off-Road with this. And if you have any questions or anything else that you want to ask after we run through a handful of these questions, feel free. Right there, Travis has a microphone. You can just flag him down and ask any questions you'd like. But first thing I want to go into is you mentioned openers. What is an opener?
For me, an opener is something that is going to get me to go through all my zones. Normally include a lot of threshold and a few VO2 sprints.
So that's hard stuff, right?
Yeah, but nothing too long that's going to fatigue me, like a max, you know, threshold of 2 minutes. Maybe I'll do tempo for 5, and then sprint efforts of 30 seconds. And if my legs are still feeling tired, I'll do a little cadence build just to get my heart rate up.
Oh, okay. That makes sense then, yeah.
I want to know, what do you guys eat like the week before a race like this? And then what do you eat race morning?
Because most people like to eat, we all like the pasta feed sort of thing. We just eat as much pasta as we possibly can, right? Yeah. What do you do?
So I'm a big proponent of kind of creating life habits rather than doing really specific things before races. It's all, you know, you always hear that phrase that you shouldn't change anything about your bike the day of a race. And so it's always a little funny to me that people do all of these extra bells and whistles things the day of a race or right before a race. And so I try to do a good job of nutrition all the time, within reason, you know, while still enjoying food. And so I just try to eat a well-balanced meal the night before, which will include some vegetables, some carbs, and some protein. A lot of times that's chicken or salmon and rice. One thing I am really consistent with is my breakfast, though, and that's regardless of race morning or any morning. I just love eggs and toast. I mean, it sounds boring, but I do it almost every single morning, and Sometimes if I get fancy, I combine the two and make French toast, but that's about it.
What do you eat race morning, Sophia? Like leading into a race, like tomorrow morning, what are you going to eat before you race?
I'm a big fan of pancakes with either peanut butter, almond butter, yogurt, and banana. But the one thing on nutrition I want to touch base on with Payson is the fact that, yeah, you stay consistent, but the one thing I take out is raw greens like kale, arugula, all that salad stuff. Like I really eat a lot of salads the week, like the few days leading into it, but 2 days before, the night before, I completely cut it out because that's how you can get sick really easily.
No, that's a great point, and I should have touched on that. I'm not eating, you know, some huge Caesar salad the night before. you don't want a whole bunch of fiber. But yeah, basically what Sophia said, I would agree with that.
So it's not the time to cut weight the night before a race with the salad. Yeah, yeah. Race morning, let's talk about your equipment. How did you decide on this course? I saw a bunch of people today out on course on hardtails or full suspension bikes, a full mix. What are you riding and how do you come across that decision or how do you make that decision, Sophia?
I am riding the Pivot Cycle Less 29er. Okay. So it's a hardtail with a dropper post. We have so much climbing out here tomorrow that's where the race, I think, it's going to be won. But you still want to be able to descend a little bit faster, which is why I have my Fox dropper post on there. But weight, when you're climbing for 35 miles, really, really matters. So you look at the profile.
What about tires? How do you choose what tire to use in a race like this?
It's funny. I normally run the Maxxis Aspens, but I am running Icons this weekend because I wanted to have a higher thread count. They give us some special 170 Icons. So.
Ooh, fancy pro tires.
I know. I feel like a princess. So I'm actually running the Icons just because I want to save my Aspens for cross-country racing.
Gotcha. So, Payson, what bike are you riding? Why did you decide on that over the other option? And same thing with tires.
Yeah, I'm going to be riding my Trek Pro Caliber this weekend, which is Trek's hardtail. It's not a true hardtail because it's got a decoupler on there that provides a little more compliance, which is a great asset. But yeah, similar to Sophia, I mean, the amount of climbing here is the defining factor.
Yeah.
I don't think this race is going to be won on the descent unless it's really tight. So that's just the choice for me. I'm on Kenda tires. The tire I'm on, I can't really talk about, but it's...
Ooh, even more sneaky.
So go look at his bike.
Go look, everybody.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm very excited about this course because it is kind of a unique technical challenge in that there's no huge defining rock garden or something like that, but it's always just a little bit slippery and takes some dexterity kind of at all times, so you have to be on point.
So when I was pre-riding the course last week, I pride myself on usually never getting flats, and I double flatted and they wouldn't seal and I had to plug them. It was in one specific spot, and when I got a flat, and I don't know if any of you guys, when you get flats and it doesn't seal, it's the most frustrating thing, but I realized that I have my tire plugs in my pack, packed away. I had to pull them out, thread the tire plug, and the whole time the air was just going out of my tire. What do you guys carry with you to fix a flat? And then what's like your strategy? So like, what do you do? Like, do you carry it in a special way to make it easier?
One, I don't flat.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Jinxed.
Yeah, right?
When you turn the conversation to sealant, this is where this whole situation gets a little more...
That's true. We have stands
testy.
Versus orange yeah. seal up here. Yeah.
No, but the main thing, at least for the sealant I run, is I always make sure I have the stands race sealant, which is actually a sealant that's more aggressive and the particles are bigger, so that's hopefully going to help me seal it. But I do carry tire plugs. They're just the Genuine Innovation ones, and I have it taped on my handlebar already threaded with the tape that's on there kind of like flap, so I can it's already really easy to peel and I don't have to like start digging at it. And then I will have a CO2 ready in my back pocket, and then I'm actually going to carry a Krieg bag in the back with my tube, tire lever, more CO2s, and a tool, multi-tool.
Clever. Payson, do you carry like a tire plug kit on every one of these races, and where do you keep it?
Yeah, I mean, I've had incredible luck with Orange Seal, but the truth of the matter is sometimes you put a slice in your tire that no sealant is gonna seal. So similar to Sophia, I carry tire plugs and exact same method. You have a little electrical tape thing, and you can kind of double the tape over and make a little quick pull tab. And it's amazing. I mean, those tire plugs, they've gotten really popular in the last few years, and you end up losing 20 to 30 seconds instead of 2.5-3 minutes. So you can still win a race if your tire doesn't seal. So it's been a game changer for sure. Huh.
You guys mentioned that this race is going to be won, like, on the climb. How do you approach, like, the start? And do you just kind of go with how it goes, or do you try to pace yourself? Because there's a lot of climbing.
And if I can jump in on that, it was absurd. Everybody in the 50-mile race, you should be sorry for that.
You went
it started
so, fast.
So hard. It was ridiculous. Way too hard today. Like, how do you decide to stick with that group?
It wasn't sustainable. It slowed down.
It's totally not sustainable. Yeah. So when it starts hard like that, do you stick with them or do you play the long ball?
Well, with us, we have, I think you guys had it too, but we have a neutral in quotes, rollout. I mean, I know the guys are doing like a really hard threshold. In the girls' race, we kind of cruise a little bit. But there's a really big fight to that first single track. And, you know, here we have a really steep fire road climb to lead into that. So there's going to be a lot of attacks going into there. Just so whoever gets there first is going to lead their own pace up the climb. And
so you fight for that then. You're willing to sacrifice and work really hard in the beginning to get into position.
Yeah, because then it's like if you have the girl or the, you know, like Howard Grotz that in front, then it's like you block that person and then you set your own pace and that's a lot more comfortable. But then once you open up in the fire road, it's better to suffer and do one VO2 max effort at the lower altitude because it'll pay dividends if you're able to hide with the wind.
That's that clever. Is so cool that because I noticed today that once you get to the high elevation, you just have no power. So put it out early.
Yeah.
Well, maybe
early.
That's just me. But.
It's crazy, right? Yeah, it's tough. Payson, for you, kind of, I guess, the same question. When it starts hard like that, something that I see is, you know, everyone wants to stay in a group, but if you're riding slow enough, the drafting doesn't matter. Why do you want to stay with that group instead of ride your own race?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I think there's a big psychological component. When you feel like you're in the group and you have a wheel in front of you, you're chasing a carrot. And it's just a lot easier. So we've been talking about how this race is going to get decided on the climb. But to be honest, in 2016, when we did this race, this similar course for the first time, I was amazed by how big the group was at Spooner Lake. It was like 9 or 10 guys. And then going over the high point of the course, we had 6. And it didn't break up until the Secret Trail descent and then the Ash to Kings climb. And even then, the gaps were relatively small. So even though this course has an amazing amount of climbing, it's pretty fast climbing and it's pretty stair-steppy and there's opportunities to recover. Mm-hmm. And so I am going to be okay with going into the red a little longer and a little more frequently than I would in other races with this much climbing because it does have more of that road back and forth type dynamic. So long story short, I'm very curious as to how it's going to play out. I think going up Snapdragon is going to be different than it was in 2016. From what I remember, that's a pretty good climb.
Yeah.
Time will tell.
Sophia, would you ever, if someone is going down really hard and it's about to go into a descent, would you kind of ever let them gap you if you know you're a better descender than them? Or how does that play out? Or do you try to then actually go harder so you can get in front of them?
No, it's funny. Actually, I raced the Whiskey 50, which is the first round of the Epic Rides, and there was a two-track road that takes you to Skull Valley Climb, but you actually descend down, and I actually let two girls go in front of me because I knew if I put my dropper pose down and I get really tucked and risk it in the corners, that I would be able to catch them. So it really depends on who it is and how you're feeling too. Ideally, you're with them, so you're not losing any time, but sometimes being able to ride your own pace for 10, 15 minutes, knowing that you can catch them on the descents is a good idea.
A question for you, Payson. Do pros also ask people to move over? Like us average Joes, we're constantly like, hey, whenever you get a chance, move on over. Does that happen with you guys?
It totally depends on the racer. So we race each other many weekends out of the summer, and so we get to know each other pretty well. I know a few racers who it's not even worth asking them to move over. And then there's...
Who?
No worries.
One of them doesn't race anymore, but... some of the folks, another consideration is that if you let someone by, say you're struggling on a descent or even struggling on a climb, if you let someone by, that person might pull you along and actually help you. So, you just kind of have to read the race and decide in the moment what makes sense.
Totally makes sense.
In today's race, there's a lot of descents that are really sandy. How do you guys approach like a sandy, steep descent? Sophia?
First thing first, unlock suspension, dropper post down just to get my body a little bit lower than normal, my center of gravity over that bottom bracket. And I really trust my tires, you know, and it's a lot of more confidence. And, you know, I'm ready if I need to put a foot out, I'm ready. But most of the time, I think the sand here actually will hold you pretty well.
What about you, Payson?
Yeah, so it's funny. Whenever someone asks me about riding in sand, for whatever reason, this quote from Ned Overend always comes back. I bought his book when I was about 10 years old, and he said about sand that riding through sand is sort of like steering a ship, where you just have to be patient. Like, you'll turn it, and then your bike doesn't seem to follow immediately. And so you just sort of have to be patient, stay balanced, and it helps to be really comfortable moving all over your bike because you're constantly having to adjust body weight and that sort of thing.
Makes sense.
So it's a finesse thing.
So we're going to run into some nutrition questions, but if anybody has questions to ask the riders, find Travis over here, that guy. We're going to ask some, and go ahead and queue up on him if you want. But we're going to ask some questions here just about like the nutrition that they carry during the race. That's the point that we talk about a lot, at least Nate and I. It's something that we're constantly testing out and trying. I'm sure a lot of you saw people out there suffering in the heat or completely bonked, maybe sleeping under a rock or a tree for a while. Yeah, exactly. What do you carry with you, and how do you decide what to eat when you're racing?
I carry all my solids with me. I am lucky enough, Payson, too, to be sponsored by Goo Energy. So we have plethora of goos and chomps. So I actually run a goo flask just because I can't tolerate the consistency of the goo. Okay. So I pre-mix my flask with water, and I'm always for chocolate because then it's like a chocolate milkshake or something I'm having.
It's always good.
Yeah, it makes it more enjoyable. And then a lot of chomps. And then for hydration, I'll run a mix, but then do one bottle of mix and then one bottle of water just because I don't want to upset my stomach because that's a lot of sugar I'm taking in over the 3 hours.
Payson, how about you? Are you the type of person that uses like a carb drink, or do you eat food on the bike?
Both. I'm someone that believes in taking in a pretty good number of calories during the race, if at all possible. So, eating a lot of goo chews and gels. I try to mix it up. Usually it works out that in the first 30 minutes of the race, there's a lot of back and forth, and it helps to be a little more focused on the job at hand. And so usually I'll start with a gel because it's easier. And then once things simmer down a little bit, I'll go to chews. And then as the race heats back up again towards the end, I'll go back to gels.
So as intensity rises, like, I guess the food gets more liquidy.
Yeah,
is that fair to say?
For sure.
Huh.
And then in terms,
go ahead.
Yeah, in terms of hydration, I kind of do a taper of sorts, I guess. So I'll start with a carb mix. About halfway through, typically, I'll drink a Red Bull just in a bottle. And then usually I go to water for the last hour or so, just because by that point your mouth can have a little bit of sugar fatigue.
Yeah, no doubt.
For lack of a better term.
How many calories an hour are you guys eating? Do you have like a target, or do you just eat how you feel?
That depends. In the scheme of things, these marathons are shorter marathons. But usually, what was the question again?
How many calories an hour?
Oh, yeah. Usually I shoot for 200-ish. But it depends on environmental factors, depends on the race dynamics. Sometimes you want more, sometimes you want less. Just depends.
Sophia?
Almost the same, and I do half of that in the liquid form and the other half in a solid form.
That's a lot of, I guess, you're taking in. Are you trying to shoot for when you finish that race to be kind of like even so that you burned as much as you took in? Is that how you figure that out?
I plan it so I have enough energy to get to the finish line.
Yeah.
Not to carry any more extra food than I have to. And, you know, I'll start when I warm up. I'll probably have one block of like a full set of chews before, just so I start up pretty loaded.
Shout out to the guy that I saw today eating Meat Lover's pizza on the course. He had it in a fanny pack. So,
oh, that's legendary.
I'm sure he was calorie positive at the end of the day. Payson.
I mean, technically speaking, with a race this intense, you can't keep up. I mean, you're burning 1,000 or more calories an hour, and your body can't process that many in an hour. So depending on the person, 150 to 300 is what your gut can handle and actually utilize. So that's how you arrive at that number.
And this is exactly why a big good, healthy breakfast matters, because you get topped off and then it's not like on the race matters less, but it doesn't play as big of a factor if you're already, you know, if you wake up and don't eat anything, then yeah, whatever you have on the bike is going to make a really big difference. But having a really good big breakfast in the morning will make sure that you're topped off on fuel.
Awesome. Let's go to some of the questions that we have here. Travis, does the mic work?
Yep.
Awesome. Cool.
I was injured and couldn't train a lot, and so I got all the stuff the youth trainer wrote, but then I'm mid-season for race season, and I'm wondering, how do you factor in a training program on a trainer when you're spending so much time outdoors?
Yeah, I think that maybe, you know, Payson and Sophia are constantly traveling, racing. It's like a kind of a different deal for most of us average Joes, at least for me when I'm in this situation. I work constantly. I don't have the time to get out and do really long rides, so I focus on getting in my quality. And even in the middle of race season, I still do. You know, it's the three sessions a week, two sessions a week, maybe even just one, but I make them high quality. And I've noticed that when I drop off that high quality, it starts to drop off. Like, whether it's inside or outside, if you're not maintaining some of that high quality work throughout your race season, you can't just rely on the racing and a long ride every once in a while. I would assume that you guys would sympathize with that. Like, you still keep up on interval work throughout the season, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any official relationship with Trainer Road, but I will say that I'm a huge believer in very specific training, whether that's pedaling drills or intervals or whatever. And a lot of times the best way to do that is indoors. Living in Durango, Colorado, we get days in the winter where you just can't ride outside. And years ago, I thought of those as real bummer days, but now I think of them more as opportunities, because it gives you a chance to really fine tune biomechanics or training. And really high intensity but short interval days can actually be a great early season thing to do. I mean,
which is contrary to popular belief,
right? I mean, there's a lot of science now that says that a little phase of high intensity training before you start quote unquote base season is a great idea, which is a really good thing for those of us that live in wintry climates, so you're not doing 5-hour rides all winter
and don't have time, right? Yeah. Sophia, you still keep up intensity all throughout the week too? I know that you have like a little pain cave set up like down in the basement in the house, but do you keep up in high intensity intervals all year? I should say through the race season?
Yeah, I think especially through the race season, I'm working more on my punchy and my VO2 just because I've had months and months of just good prep work on working on my threshold. So once I'm getting to my peak season, it's a lot more of dialing in, you know, that 30 to 5-minute power rather than my 30-minute threshold or doing my sweet spot work.
That makes sense. Perfect. Let's do it. So the question, I'm going to reiterate that for the people on the internet. So the question was, working at a chocolate shop, how do you not eat all the chocolate?
Or even broader, like how do you, like cravings and sweets, like, how do you not just indulge in that all the time?
Yeah, so I work for Ritual Chocolate, which is the bean-to-bar chocolate company based out in Park City. One of the owners, Robbie, he's actually here racing. He's going to race the pro race tomorrow.
It's next level. Don't go there if you want to not, you know. If you like gaining weight, it's great. So.
Yeah. But the chocolate is really good. It's healthy chocolate. It's simple ingredients, just cacao. Butter and then organic cane sugar. So it's a really dark chocolate. So for me, a bite or two will satisfy me. Except the other day, well, a few months ago, we released a vanilla bar, and that one I could eat the full bar. But it's just, I always have a little bite or two of chocolate a day. And there's actually a lot of research that shows that chocolate has the same health benefits than beets. So
I'm taking that one to the bank.
I believe it because I want to.
Yeah. And there's like theobromine that helps, you know, with cardiovascular stuff, so it's actually pretty healthy. It's just eating the good chocolate, which is what we make. But yeah, it can be deadly.
So Payson, you're a very you're slim, right? And so how do you, like, do you get cravings, and then how do you deal with that, like, to keep the weight down?
One thing, Payson, really quick, especially because you drive a lot. I mean, you have a van that you live out of for a lot of the race season too, so that's even harder when you're on the road dealing with that.
Yeah, so my trick for not eating that stuff is just try not to have it around, honestly. Like, probably a lot of people assume that as a pro athlete, I have some crazy ability to you know, deny myself of tasty things, but really my willpower is pretty bad when there's anything tasty right in front of me. You know, I mean, we have amazing craft breweries in Durango, so, you know, I try not to buy too many of those, not too much chocolate, all that sort of thing. So, there's some people who watch their diet very closely. I'm not really one of those people. I try to eat a well-balanced and healthy diet, but I also like to enjoy my food. So it's all about balance. And when I do fail in terms of willpower at the grocery store, I usually burn through whatever amazing tastiness I bought in a day anyway, and then it's gone. It's kind of like a kid in Halloween candy. You know, there's no...
Just get it done.
Exactly.
Going into the indulging, like, I'm not a drinker. Like, I don't like beer. I don't like wine. So I'm a firm believer in eating my calories. So, like, candy, like, actually sugar candy, it's quite deadly for me. But then I justify it. I'm like, oh, well, this amount of candy equals one beer. So you had two beers, Keegan. I get to have this much candy.
And for those that don't know, Keegan Swenson is Sophia's boyfriend, what she's saying there. So that's a good way to measure it out. I don't drink either. I should start taking advantage of that. That's pretty good.
I think I got two more out here.
Let's do two more and we'll wrap it up. So that was a great question. Basically, any budget altitude tips or anything that we do, to I guess acclimatize ourselves at elevation. What do you do? I know you live also at high elevation, but how do you adjust and how do you train for that?
You know, to the question, I actually go to the winter. I go to Southern California to train, and I actually really enjoy training at sea level. You get some VO2 work and even like threshold work. You're able to repeat a lot of your numbers more often just because there's not that oxygen deprivation that you have. But I think when I go from sea level back to altitude, I think mentally I need to know that my power numbers are not going to look as great anymore. I am not going to be doing threshold at 250. And that to me psychologically gets to me because I feel like, I'm weaker. But then I rely a lot more on my heart rate to look at kind of my effort, and then just knowing the higher and higher I go, the harder and harder is going to get, and the more I should back up. So it's really learning to feel what threshold feels like at sea level or altitude. It should really feel the same. It's just that being able to repeat it that changes.
Good tip. Payson, what do you do to any tips, I guess, or little aces up the sleeve for elevation?
Yeah, so I actually came from sea level also. I moved to elevation about 7 years ago, and it took me a good couple few years to adapt and really fulfill any sort of potential, I guess, at riding and racing at elevation. Unfortunately, you can't hack your physiology. You can't, I mean, it's a physiological thing that you're up against. You know, these races are amazing because they're in the mountains, but that also usually means we're at elevation. So I guess the tip I would give is just staying within yourself, because that's really the nail in your coffin when you're racing at elevation, is if you go into that red zone and you quote unquote blow up, like Sophia was saying, at sea level, you recover much more quickly and you can get your legs back under you. But if you blow up at 9,000 feet, it's a long time until you come back.
There might not be a time, actually.
There may not be a time, yeah, exactly. So, yeah.
Showing up the day before as close to the race as possible from low elevation to high elevation. Is that still standard, or is there a certain amount of time? Is that shifted?
So the question was, what's the best time to kind of come up to elevation? And recently we've done a podcast on this, and there's two schools of thought. One is come up like the day of, or spend up there 3 weeks. But there was also Team Sky, they did some power numbers. And actually after, I think, 7 days, like the first day, it was like 40 or 50 watts less than threshold. But after a few days of workouts, it was close to what it was down at sea level. So with all things in science, it's frustrating when two things contradict each other. So I don't really know the real answer yet, and hopefully we'll find out more.
Yeah, it's also another point that it's very individual. And even amongst that set of data that I'm sure they got from Team Sky in this situation, I guarantee you that there was a lot of variance across that depending on person to person. And something that I would say just on a tip for Elevation is to learn how you react to it, because you may very well be a person that finds out that, you know, yeah, your book of matches, so to speak, is limited. But you may find that as long as you stay within a certain limit, you're actually, relatively to other people, you may be really efficient at Elevation. It's just you can't cross a certain limit. So if you can spend time exploring and trying to learn from yourself at Elevation instead of just, you know, hammering and racing and trying to go as hard as you can, that can really help. Last question. So the question on that was, how do you decide which tire pressure you run? And then when do you decide to increase or decrease that tire pressure?
So that depends on a handful of factors. Rim diameter or rim width changes, you know, the profile of your tire. So that's a consideration. When you have a wider rim, you're able to run lower pressures. The volume of the tire is the big thing. So if you run if I'm running a 2.3 tire, I'll run 19 PSI. So I'm running 2.2s tomorrow, and I'm going to do 23 in the back and 22 in the front.
Sophia.
Yeah, I'm running a 2.25 Icon, and I'm going to go, I'm playing around between 17-18 or 18-19. I would go up in more tire pressure if there was a lot of road climbing, fire road, not that much technical aspect to it. And then if the weather was to turn and it would be raining and muddy, then I would drastically decrease that tire pressure. But for almost all the races, I always start at 18, 19, you know, especially in cross-country races when you can pre-ride, and then adjust up and down from there.
One thing to note, too, is the weight difference. Is that's why you see the difference in tire pressure. So, Like, if you're a 180-pound guy, don't go run probably 17 PSI.
Probably not a good idea. Something else, one last tip on this is, because it's so sandy here, I actually ran less. I ran 18 and 19 PSI and 2.25 Aspens, Maxxis Aspens. And I did that because it's so sandy, I actually get a little bit more of a flatter contact patch, a little bit more stability and flotation on some of the sand, too. So plenty of factors go into it. Well, thanks, everybody, for joining us. We appreciate it. If you can give a round of applause here for Keegan and for giving me Payson and Sophia for joining us up here. It's pretty great of them to do this the night before their big race. So thanks again, guys. And well, I guess we'll see you all out here tomorrow. Cheer them on.
Great. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.